Hello there. It's been a little while since you and I have talked. This is Pastor Bill bringing you News in Focus. I want to bring you a short article called How Johann Sebastian Bach Taught His Students. Four Simple Methods Every Parent and Teacher Should Know. This is from intellectualtakeout.org. And March 21st marks the birthday of one of the greatest composers of all time, Johann Sebastian Bach. Beyond being a great composer, Bach was also a great teacher who raised many pupils to be masters of their craft. According to his first biographer, Johann Nicholas Forkel, Bach's success as a teacher resulted in part from the following four traits. Number one, he practiced self-instruction. Okay. Why was this man a successful teacher? One, he practiced self-instruction. The biographer notes, he was a good teacher because he took great pains to learn and develop his own knowledge and talent. To teach well, a man needs to have a full mind. He must have discovered how to meet and overcome the obstacles in his own path before he can be successful in teaching others how to avoid them. Bach united both qualities. Hence, as a teacher, he was the most instructive, clear, and definite that has ever been. In every branch of his art, he produced a band of pupils who followed in his steps without, however, equaling his achievement. Well, now, what does this mean? Well, it means that you never stop being a student. I'm amazed, actually, I guess the most fresh talking point on this I have is when I meet other chaplains in the Army Reserve and they know nothing. They know nothing about being a chaplain because they are only chaplains 3 or 4 days out of the month, and they don't read any chaplaincy material between that time. They don't know how the Army works. They don't know how their office is supposed to function. They don't know how they're supposed to fit into a staff. They don't read philosophy of the Army chaplaincy, Department of Defense chaplaincy. They don't know how to, and so they save that. I don't know what they save it for, but I think they just expect every now and then to go to a school for that their service provides for them, and that they'll learn everything they need. And then they further know nothing about pastoral ministry. Some of them, they don't do that. They are prison guards, and they don't practice their craft. They are Border Patrol agents, and I thank God for them, but they don't practice their craft. They are never going to be experted. They're going to continually, if God forbid, they get promoted, and they have chaplains under them that they are mentoring and crafting and coaching. They're going to leave them out there flapping. And my friends, I have been party to much of that. And so when it comes to pastoral ministry, how would you feel about having a surgeon that never read medical journals, a pharmaceutical technician that never understood the control mechanisms involved in their craft? How would you feel about a lawyer that never considered jurisprudence or precedence in their craft? How would you feel about an aviator that never was interested in doing research on a particular piece of equipment or a particular aircraft? Of course, you know the answer is you wouldn't trust them further than you could throw them. Well, how do you feel about a teacher that steps into the classroom and is teaching almost entirely what they taught the last cycle? I was always amazed when I went to an Army school as an enlisted soldier, and I haven't noticed this so much as a chaplain, but definitely when I went to what is used to be known as BNOC, I guess now it's called ALC, and I remember thinking, and even when I was training to be a prime power production specialist, I remember thinking, these guys are never around until it is their time to be behind the podium. And then they're lost going through their notes. They're trying to make sure they're keeping up with the slides. You're like, I wonder if they understand that part of their job is to improve the course. And so I am totally on board with self-instruction. Teaching from the overflow is amazing. When you're just pulling things from your own research, your own study, your own experiences, and you're not wasting time telling jokes or, I know that we call it building rapport, I know that, but I tell you one way you can build a rapport with your students is to know what in the world you're saying. You know, you don't have to tell 17 jokes and know everyone's birthday for you to have a good rapport with students who are paying, their parents are paying tuition dollars and producing work that if you don't use your class time well, they're going to think the reason they have homework is because you're a poor classroom manager. Number two, he was unafraid to drill excessively. Today's teachers are told that drilling is a no-no, which will kill all creativity and enthusiasm in a child. But each understood that drilling was necessary for students to lay a good foundation for future success. And when drilling became tedious, each Bach found ways to make lessons fun. Here's the quote. For months together, he made them practice nothing but simple exercises for the fingers of both hands, at the same time emphasizing the need for clearness and distinctness. He kept them at these exercises for from 6 to 12 months, unless he found his pupils losing heart, in which case he so far met them as to write short studies which incorporated a particular exercise. So we can't get past this drilling thing. I, as a soccer coach, know that your feet become more nimble when you do certain things with them. Goalkeepers, their fingers are more prepared when they do more things with them. When they clap their fingers hundreds of times a day, keeping the heels of their palms together, that keeps them nimble and ready and more reactive. Being able to fall quickly, believe it or not, is a great science. And most people don't know how to fall quickly as goalkeepers. And so the ball will often go under the body into the goal for beginner goalkeepers. And then the ones that aren't beginners are the ones that are no good. They get bored with it. They find something else to do, and they never go to the next level. And I guess what I'm trying to say to you is that when we're talking about drills, I can remember Ms. Donna Gary getting us sharp on things like multiplication tables in our math drilling. To be fair, I don't know exactly. I don't know how the shortcut around it. What do they call it? Victory drill? I can't remember if that's what the books were called, third, fourth, fifth grade. Just lists and lists of words. And we had to be able to read through that in a certain amount of time. And we had to read through columns of long words. And I can still, after drilling, I can still recite almost the first column because of the hundreds of times, napkin, dishpan, hat box, address, ringlet, sit, over and over and over these words we would drill. And today, we have problems with just reading in front of people and remembering simple math facts. So I may not know much about professional soccer. I may not know much about public speaking. I may not know much about being quick-witted mathematically. But I know something. And when I look around today, I realize there's some value in drilling. Yeah, drilling. It's not hot and sexy, as some people would say. It's not this kind of thing that keeps you wanting to listen and do great things. Man, if I have to drill, I just don't think I'll ever do it right. And that's why you will never do anything very well. You'll just be Mr. Mediocre Guy looking to find a group of mediocre people that you can outshine. And that is one strategy. Number three, he led by example. Rather than throwing a student to the deep end and letting him figure things out on his own, he took time to demonstrate superior musicianship, a teaching method which was both inspiring and encouraging. A quote from the book, in order to lessen their difficulty, it was an excellent habit to play over to them the pieces they were to study with the remark, that's how it ought to be sound. That's how it ought to sound. It would be difficult to exaggerate the helpfulness of this method. The pupil's interest was roused by hearing the piece properly played. But that was not the sole result. Without the help thus given, the pupil could only hope to overcome difficulties of the piece after considerable effort, and would find it much less easy to realize a proper rendering of it. So, again, he would say, here, this is what you need to play, and here's how it ought to sound. And I can't speak to your world, but surely you know what I'm talking about when you say, now watch what I'm doing here. And when you can strike the ball the way that it ought to be struck, the players not only know that you have respectability, but they have just seen how it ought to be done, and they know it can be done. If the old overweight guy in his 30s can do it, certainly I can do it in my teens. If this guy can prepare a message and I know how scatterbrained he can be, maybe I can do it. If this guy can have a decent home with a relative amount of peace in it, if he can serve his wife well, and if I can observe it, I might be able to follow that example. That kind of thing. Number four, and this is last. He introduced students to good material. It is often said that it doesn't matter the quality of books children read, just as long as they're reading something. Bach would have contested that statement, for he insisted that his students only work with high-quality material in order to develop early knowledge of the good and beautiful. Here's what the book says. As long as his pupils were under his instruction, Bach did not allow them to study any but his own works and the classics. The critical sense, which permits a man to distinguish good from bad, develops later than the aesthetic faculty and may be blunted and even destroyed by frequent contact with bad music. The best way to instruct youth is to accustom it early to consort with the best models. And I can just, again, coming back to my field, I can tell you that it may sound like a great sermon, but if I don't think it is, I'm going to make sure that people in my influence only listen to it as people who have been already stocked with things to look for in the realm of the bad. Hey, notice how he leads the text. Notice how he uses most of his time telling stories. Notice how he spends most of his time trying to be funny. Notice how he never looks at his audience. As you watch the video, notice how he's always looking at the podium or the walls. Hey, I want you to be... If you don't do that, they might actually sit there and think it's a decent message, and then what's the point of the instruction? What's the point of the instruction if you can't find any good examples of what you're trying to say? Haven't you read anything good in your field? Then give them that. If there's something that they ought to read that would be good for them that is not considered good, well, then it's good. What I mean by that, listen, it sounds like I just double-talked. But a while ago, several years ago, Rob Bell wrote a book called Love Wins. It's a horrible book. I read it. It's a horrible book. It's formatted for a five-year-old, and it reads like someone who hasn't read his Bible through. I'm convinced he's not a theologian in the slightest. He may be, but he sure doesn't write like one. He writes like someone who doesn't know anything. So when I had a student come to me a year or two ago, wanted something to read in his spare time, I said, all right, here's what you need to look for. Check this book out. Notice how he makes this mistake, that mistake. And then when you come back, we're going to talk about those things. That, in my opinion, is good material. Why? Because it's so horrible that it's a great teaching tool. Tomorrow night's message, I'm going to share some Seventh-day Adventist sources just for a minute or two on how they feel about a particular verse in the book of Matthew and how their topical perspective colors how they deal with a passage of Scripture because they won't stay at home in the passage. I want people to know what sloppy exegesis looks like. I want them to know what good exegesis looks like, but they can't do that if the teacher is not saying, here's what to look for. So good things. I enjoyed this piece. Four things that Bach did that made him an excellent teacher. Practice self-instruction, unafraid to drill excessively, lead by example, and give your students good material. No busy work. Don't be one of those idiot teachers that just does busy work, and you come back and the kid just basically checks a box because you're too lazy to make a meaningful assignment. Well, thanks for your time, and I appreciate you listening in.